A Different Kind of Leader captures insights from diverse leaders in healthcare, public health, and academic settings so that our organizations are in a stronger position to grow, innovate, and meet the challenges of our day. To our listeners, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Giselle Corby-Smith. I'm the host of A Different Kind of Leader. I'm so excited to have a dear friend and longtime colleague here with me, Dr. Joseph Bettencourt. Joe is the Vice President and Chief Equity and Inclusion Officer of Massachusetts General Hospital and the founder and senior advisor and faculty of the Disparity Solutions Center at MGH. He has been doing this work around equity, diversity, and inclusion for as long as we've actually been faculty members. So I'm so thrilled to have him here. Joe is nationally and internationally recognized expert in health policy, healthcare disparities, diversity, cross-cultural medicine, and has served on several Institute of Medicine or National Academy committees, including the one that many of us in the field see as a landmark report, Unequal Treatment, as well as Increasing Diversity in the Healthcare Workforce. He's been funded, he has multiple publications, he's done all the things. I'm so excited to be joined by my friend and colleague, Joe. Joe, welcome.
Thank you so much, Giselle. It's great to be with you and great to see you. And we've come such a long way, and I feel like I've grown up with you in this work. So it's an honor and a pleasure to be invited to be part of this, and so thankful you're doing it. And I look forward to a conversation among friends.
I'm so thrilled that you're here. So, Joe, tell us a little bit about how you got started. Not just so much how you got started in this work, but one of the things that we hope is that this podcast can also inspire folks that are starting in this journey. And as you said, but we've both been doing this together for a long time. Tell folks a little bit about how you got started, how you got into medicine, and then how you got into the work around equity, diversity, and inclusion.
Yeah, thanks. You know, I think for so many of us, the start is way back, right? It's this work is not a job. This isn't, you know, an occupation. This is a calling. This is a dream to be able to do this work. And to tell you where it all started, I think it's important. And especially for people to hear, we kind of cycle around in different professional circles and we don't always know kind of where we really, really kind of came from. And so I was born in New York City. My parents are from Puerto Rico. My grandparents came from Puerto Rico in the late 1950s. My grandfather opened up a bodega in Spanish Harlem. One of my abuelas worked in the sweatshops in Midtown Manhattan. My other abuela was a housekeeper. And, you know, my parents came over when they were about 5 or 6 years old, and they were married. It's incredible. They were married. My dad was like 23 and my mom was 18. My mom had me when she was 19, a year after being married. So really, really young parents. My dad didn't finish high school. He experienced growing up a lot of discrimination and a lot of the demons that discrimination brings in urban environments, including, you know, substances and violence and types of things, which made him life very challenging. He didn't finish high school. He was an incredible man, but had a Jekyll and Hyde kind of existence, in that he had a life that these demons kind of pulled on him in, but he also tried to be the best father he could. And he was an incredible father. He passed away when he was 50, back when I just finished medical school. My mom was a stalwart. And I think both of them gave me a lot of key ingredients that at least got me on a path towards thinking about life and the way I think about it today. They made a lot of incredible sacrifices for me. They preached the importance of education. They gave me love despite a lot of kind of turmoil growing up, but my mom was a real anchor, and she got her associate's degree years on. I say that because I don't come from a family of doctors or a family of individuals who's had much experience in higher education. And I think about that a lot now compared to my kids who have me to coach them, and how much, quite frankly, I feel like I flew by the seat of my pants despite a lot of love and a lot of kind of the best guidance I could get. But that's my origin story. And I think, you know, I early on, I went to 5 schools in my first 6 years of first grade through sixth, living between New York and Puerto Rico and then coming back to New Jersey. And so kind of a bit of a crazy time, but still, I think my parents instilled in me this tunnel vision, this idea that we can try to set the table, but you got to eat, like you got to be focused, and there's going to be stuff that happens around you, but you got to really be focused. And I got this idea that early on that for many of our communities, right, the regal professions, right, are those like lawyers and doctors and things. And I started to learn about being a doctor. I liked interacting with kids at a young, with people at a young age, and I liked science. And so at a very, very early age, I'd say in elementary school, I said, I want to be a doctor. I put it on my high school yearbook. I think about how gutsy that was now, because I could not, that may not have gone very well. That could have lived it in for me. But I guess to bring this part, that chapter of my life to a close, I mean, I think they gave me the ability to tunnel and focus, to not be afraid to get up after you fall, to understand that all you could do is give it your best. And so they didn't put undue pressure on me. The only pressure they put on me was to do my best. They gave me a commitment to own the importance of getting an education for me, not for them. My dad used to say it all the time, you're not doing this for me. My life is my life. You're doing it for you, and you're doing it for your kids, to give your kids things that I can't give you. So it's that set of philosophies that I think gave me the ability to dream and to think that in retrospect, to have the audacity to think I could kind of do this and do it. But they gave me confidence. And I think that confidence is important, because they gave me the ability to believe that I could do it. I had a short time horizon. I'd say, this is the next deadline. This is the next deadline. But you'd line them up and knock them down. And that was where the dream of becoming a physician began for me.
I love that there's so much about what you've just described in your growing up that resonates with me, right? A lot of, at least in my family, coming from the Caribbean as well, there wasn't a whole lot of conversation, but there was incredible example. Incredible. It was sort of living the values and principles by example. And what I witnessed, a couple little quotes here and there, but really it was just the amazing fortitude and to witness what they overcame. And the selflessness of saying, this is not about me. This is about what I want for you in your life.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And I mean, I think you and I lived a very different life when we were in our 20s. I mean, we were working hard a different way, but my parents didn't get new clothes. We didn't go on vacations. I mean, they didn't do things for themselves so that I can have a chance. And you live with the weight of that. And you live with the sense of like responsibility to them and to their sacrifice, to honor their sacrifice.
Yeah.
But it's, if you channel it the right way, it's just the right level of drive, but not kind of paralyzing kind of anxiety of if I don't. No, it was never that way. It's like, just do your best.
Yeah.
And we have confidence that your best is going to be good enough. But, you know, and if this, and they tell me,
right,
if this doctor thing works out, that's all good. And if it doesn't, you're going to do other stuff. So that, there was always this pressure valve, right? Where like, they knew I was setting the bar really high, setting my goals high, but they let me know that if you don't reach that, there's plenty of ways to get to where you want to be. So, yeah.
I told someone probably 20 years ago, I said, if this whole gig doesn't work out, I know that I can always pack up my bags, take my kids, and go to my parents' house. There's like no questions asked. I'll show up at the front door and they're like, okay, come on in. The room's over there, you know?
No, the support is incredible, and a little bit of love goes a long way. And yeah, I live honoring that story every day. I mean, every day I think about that. There's not a single day that doesn't go by where I'm not thinking about, am I living the values and principles in which I was raised today? And I'll tell you, it's an absolute dream to be able to be in a profession where I'm able to do that every day, where I don't have to find it through a hobby or through volunteer activities, where it's my day-to-day work.
Yeah. Now, one of our first points of intersection, and there have been many in our careers, was that sort of landmark paper that you wrote, I think it was in Annals of Internal Medicine, that really, for so many of us that were seeing health inequalities all around us, and you really sort of put on the table for all to really witness this issue around cross-cultural communication and sort of what it means to really be a physician for all people. If we're really about this, how do we ensure that those that are not getting the kind of care that they should in a healthcare system are actually have access to that? So can you say more about that moment and sort of how, what, at least for me, it was an inflection point in my career, but also thinking about sort of what that meant for you and sort of how you moved forward?
Yeah, late 90s. I mean, and that was a culmination, just I think, of these next chapters of a journey that included being able to realize some of those things that I put on paper myself, right? So, you know, being driven to be a doctor came as a Puerto Rican with the weight of bringing the voice of many who weren't at the table to the table to be able to stand up. And early on, when I thought about when I was thinking about and aspiring to be a doctor, I understood that responsibility. And in medical school, I think I saw that directly when I just looked around, didn't see a lot of people like me. Then I started to look at a lot of national statistics, which said, yeah, you're right. There aren't a lot of people like you here, which further added to that sense of responsibility. And then I think being a medical student and walking around and seeing that because I spoke Spanish, I had a window and a connection and almost a natural set of trust with certain patients that because I had a certain lived experience, I had a window, a certain connection, a certain set of trust with patients that made me an asset. That was a skill that was an asset. And then kind of moving forward in residency, kind of beginning to really commit to what does this look like? How do we become more diverse? How can I teach what in some ways is to some degree, not innate, but it's built into who I am, to others who want to really make sure that they could care for anyone at a high level from anywhere at any time. And to me, that paper was just talking about the fact that there's this big move on cultural competence, understanding people from different cultures. And it was almost a stereotyping approach, this menu-based approach that treated people of different cultures as exotic. And what we said is, look, if you want to be a doctor, you have to be, you are a doctor for all people. That's who you are by getting into this profession. And you'd be remiss to not be skilled to communicate and care for anyone from anywhere at any time at a high level. So this shouldn't be some type of remediation or punitive course that you need to take. This is about completing yourself as a healer. And what we tried to articulate in that paper, this kind of patient-based across cultural care, was to say, look, we need to learn about community, absolutely. And that's going to be very helpful. But the worst thing you could do is stereotype somebody because they come from a community and believe that they are going to behave in certain ways or believe in certain things without the points of inquiry to understand the how and the why and respecting the power of one, that every individual has their own social cultural background that influence their health beliefs and behaviors. And I think a lot about that a lot when I reflect on my time in Newark, New Jersey, where non-adherence, quote unquote, was a big issue. Mm-hmm. And people said, oh, you know, these people, stereotype, they don't care about their health, stereotype, when a little bit of inquiry would allow people to see that they're worried just about surviving on the streets, feeding their families, getting like a colonoscopy is about that, you know, or taking meds is like, that's like so far removed. Their time horizon is survival in 1 month, not 5 years. So that article, along with my colleagues, Alex Green and Emilio Garcia, tried to say, let's bring curiosity, empathy, and respect to a process of inquiry into how we care for people that takes in these things into account, understanding we don't have hours to do it, but without being reductionist, what are a couple of tools that we could use to be better at this? Hopefully have some epiphanies, buy into it and grow from there. So that was the kind of the journey to that paper, which I think was special to me, certainly. And I'm glad it was, you know, helpful to you and someone.
Yeah, it was one of those moments where it's like, I'm not alone in thinking about this, right? It's like there are other people who are thinking beyond what feels so uncomfortable in the way that cross-cultural communication is being portrayed. And so now you're VP, you have an incredible leadership perch, hard won, you know, you've done so much to get there. Can you say a little bit about that journey? What for folks that are just starting out, what would you tell them? I mean, they'll look at you and think, oh my gosh, I don't know if I can do that, or how did he get there?
I think there's a couple of things I think about, and they all drive to this idea of kind of three streams into a river. I tell people the ideal calling, which becomes a job, which becomes a profession, is really driven by three things. One, doing work that you're passionate about. Mm-hmm. Two, doing work that works towards your strengths. And three, it's work that includes day-to-day activities that you really enjoy, that are less stretch and more kind of more your strong suit, that you enjoy it. Some people, and I guess the point I'd make is that we a lot of times know what we're passionate about. Maybe that's the easiest stream to kind of reconcile or discern. The other two take a lot of time to learn. Like, you know, what I'm naturally good at and what I like my days to look like. I had to do a lot of things, try them out and be like, not for me. Oh boy, I really like that. Wow, I really love that. You know, it's so I'd say though driving towards those three things requires the hustle, meaning you need to put your hands in different cookie jars and not be afraid to try things, because that is part of the learning process to figure out what you're good at and what you like to do in a day to day. They say try fast, fail fast. You know, it is. You do want to. You don't want to take an RA job for 3 years in an area that you don't like or you're terrible at. No, you want to do something and say, okay, I like research. I like being in community. I like crunching numbers behind a computer. I like seeing patients. I like community organizing. And by trying those things, you get to learn not only what you like, but what you're good at. So I think that's a key thing. And you have to do this, Giselle, in my view, with humility, but with confidence. That set of kind of counterpoising forces is very, very important, because you need to have a quiet confidence about your ability to succeed, but do that with great humility and understand you need to learn. And for people who are getting rolling, I'd say, think about what your passion is. Today is an information age. People today can learn about things, Giselle, that you and I would have to look up in encyclopedias.
And ours were always out of date.
I mean, like, my kids can answer a question in a second. Like, you could find research opportunities, internship opportunities anywhere in the globe on any topic in a matter of minutes. Leverage that information to learn. And if you have a passion about something, you can become expert in that thing by becoming a student of it. So I think that is important. The hustle, and by the hustle, I mean networking with different people, talk to different people, be a prepared mentee though, because if you're going to meet me, the value of spending a half an hour with me is not learning what you could read about from my bio or from my website. It's having read all that already and asking me questions that you can't find anywhere. So being a prepared mentee is important, but you will want to talk to different people who are doing jobs that seem interesting to you to figure out how they got there. At the end of the day, you might put together a patchwork that becomes your own career from the different things that you hear from people. I'd say another key part of the journey is many, many people will tell you there's a well-worn road, and they will say, oh, Joe, you want to be a health service researcher. So you want to do the K, you want to do the R, you want to do this, you want to. The point is, we can't be afraid to deviate from the well-worn road. And for some, the well-worn road might be perfect, but for others, it may not. And it's not like you go into this and you're arrogant or naive and you say, no, I don't need to take advice. But you can't be afraid to disrupt a little bit, to deviate a bit from these well-worn paths, because that's where the real innovation and leadership happens, and these new positions are created and these things occur. So that's the advice I would give to people who are kind of thinking about, okay, how do I get there? And I meet with people a lot of time, they ask me, and I say, you know, there was a lot of luck, a lot of people who supported me. And there was sometimes where I asked for more than I thought. And I don't mean ask, I'm not talking about money. I'm just talking about like for leadership roles or things. And I look back, I'm like, wow. But I did it in a way I feel like, I guess I didn't offend people because I got a lot of chances.
The information age that we're in now is sort of mind boggling. And I was talking with a medical student who was like, I'm not sure about a shoulder exam. I said, don't you have YouTube? If you just Google shoulder exam, there are like 16 videos on how to do a shoulder exam. Come back to me when you have a question.
Right. So true. My kids can answer any question. I mean, like, I was trying to fix an electric sock. I'm like, oh, I got to call an electrician. My son's like, no, I'll just look it up on YouTube. So, and for medicine, it's the same thing. I mean, like you don't need to go wait for the master cert, you know, ortho instructor to teach you. You can find 15 videos on it. You know, right. Slow them down, speed them up. I agree.
Yeah.
Joe, tell me something that you're particularly proud of during your career, an accomplishment you're particularly proud of.
It's interesting, Giselle, because I just reflecting on this the other day, I've realized that part of my journey has been you don't get too high and you don't get too low. And whereas I think the you don't get too low is really protective. And I appreciate the don't get too high because you can't be feeling yourself too much. Mm-hmm. It makes you forget a lot of things that in retrospect are like, wow, that was pretty cool. But there's one that really stands out and it's very recent that I'd share. And I would say this is one that I'm saying now is definitely one of the proudest moments of my career. So, you know, when COVID hit at Mass General in March, I was asked to lead our MGH and Mass General Brigham, our parents' equity and community health efforts. We stood up a bunch of efforts and all this other stuff and these different work streams ahead of it. Why? Because we knew that these disasters always disproportionately impact vulnerable populations. We didn't exactly know how, but we started to stand up a couple of things. And one of the ideas I had, one of the worksheets we stood up was something called a multilingual registry. This idea that we were going to send a survey out to our entire institution to identify doctors, nurses, frontline staff who spoke a language other than English, with the idea that as we were redeploying, we might redeploy people with languages and asset. But I didn't know when or how or what would happen. And 2 weeks in the pandemic, I started to get these texts and emails from people in the emergency room in the ICU saying, Joe, it seems like every other patient who we're intubating is Spanish speaking. Like, this is unbelievable. And then I went into walk rounds and saw it. And then our data started to come in. And at one point, up to 45% of our COVID positive patients were Spanish speaking, right? And so, I went and did walk rounds on a Friday. And then Saturday morning, I started to think about this. And I said, I think I have an idea. And I said, we had this multilingual registry that I had somebody put together. And I said, can you pull out all Spanish-speaking doctors who signed up for that registry? And they got me the list, and it was about 50-some-odd Spanish-speaking doctors of all 15 different departments, 15 different countries. Mm-hmm. And I emailed them, and I said, look, I have this idea. We have our surge teams now, and, you know, interpreters are hard to patch into the rooms because it's all virtual, and we're conserving PPE, and there's no live interpreters in place. And I have this idea of creating something called the Spanish Language Care Group. This is an opportunity for us, me included, as a Spanish-speaking doctor and us as Spanish-speaking doctors, to figure out a way to deploy ourselves and cover the hospital 24/7 to make sure there's always a Spanish-speaking doctor for any surge team who needs us for Spanish-speaking patients. And Giselle, in a matter of a week, we worked with the Department of Hospital Medicine. 51 doctors signed up, ortho, peds, full professor, trainee, surgery. So 15 different disciplines, 15 different countries, again, ranging from trainee all the way to senior full professor who signed on to this effort. So it was beautiful.
That is like making the hair raise on the back of my neck. That is so amazing.
It was incredible. And so what we did was within a week and a half, we stood this effort up. Seven doctors, so 24-hour coverage, seven doctors during the day, four at night. And basically 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. shifts live. We did it for 6 weeks. We covered the entire hospital. So basically the way it would work is I'd show up in the morning. It's my shift. I'm covering three floors. I reach out to the floor surge teams. I say, let me know when you need me. They ping me. I do all my rounds with Spanish-speaking patients with them. So we bought, Giselle, clinical, cultural, and linguistic competence to the surge teams. And the thing that was so gratifying for me is that, one, When we walked in the room and the patients heard a Spanish-speaking doctor, mm-hmm. it was fundamentally different.
Okay, now, yeah.
Our caregiving colleagues who have been champions of diversity, they saw that. They're like, holy smokes. Like, I thought I understood diversity. I've been using interpreters. I see you all walk in the room. This is fun. I've never been mm-hmm. witnessed. They became the single biggest champions for diversity. And for us, it was like gold. I mean, yeah. The fact that we could give to our community in that way was incredible. And so the Spanish Language Care Group, and by the way, Hopkins created a similar program following our TA called Juntos. We had Boston Medical Center, but probably around 6 or 7 hospitals form similar Spanish Language Care Groups. But I'll say to me, that was my proudest moment, because I think we were able to advance a diversity conversation in ways that my colleagues now understand it. I think it will be fundamentally transformational. We were all most gratifying experience of our careers, and it made a big difference for patients.
Fantastic. Oh, that's so beautiful. I mean, just thank you for sharing that. That's amazing.
No, thank you. It was, and I'll tell you, we're getting ready for our second surge, and we'll see. You know, we might have to bring the band back together again.
I know.
For 6 weeks straight. ICUs, floors, ED, talking to families, doing histories, providing discharge instructions, end of life conversations, critical illness conversations, you know, we did it all.
Joe, we are at this, your work, I should say, your role in your work now at MGH is at this intersection of this sort of probably leadership challenges that folks in healthcare haven't seen in forever and ever in the last 100 years, right? And we have this raging pandemic, and it's we have the ongoing raging pandemic of racism and other isms in this country. The syndemic, really, the sort of coming together of these two, which creates exactly the kinds of space that you've just described, where people are suffering and alone in so many ways. What do you see sort of as a critical leadership opportunities at this moment in time?
Yeah, I think, Giselle, you and I have been doing this work. We care deeply about it. 2020 has been a transformational year. I mean, it's unique in our lifetime. It's unique in the lifetimes of many. But I would say this is a moment that you and I have been waiting for all our professional lives, mm-hmm. to be able to lead unabashedly with conversations about racism, to be able to lead unabashedly, not with the business case, but the moral case, in ways that we never did before, really was both energizing, but also created this sense of urgency in me to try to grab as much land as I can in this period while people are engaged, and grab land and then be able to get the resources and the accountability, which I equate to tilling the field and planting the seeds in ways mm-hmm. we never anticipated. Ways would have taken what we've been able to do post the COVID pandemic and how it's unfortunately impacted communities of color, and post the murder of George Floyd, in taking people into deep water, not only on these conversations, but also on what we're going to do to be different, has been unprecedented. And this is a chance of a lifetime for somebody who cares about this work to get it all. And I think that's what I've been focused on. And so from a leadership standpoint, it's been really, for me, when I started my job, it was about how do I incorporate diversity, equity, inclusion across all four pillars of our mission: care, training, research, and community health. We created, on the heels of George Floyd, something we call the Structural Equity 10-Point Plan. We processed that, got it finalized. It's tens and tens and tens of millions of dollars commitment over 5 years just to get us rolling. We have new structures, new accountabilities, new goals, new timelines. You and I have been at this work for a while, and I think the challenge has been, it's always been drip, drip, drip. Mm-hmm. And what's missed is aspiration without the rigor of execution. And this gives us a chance to bring all that rigor of execution to this work in ways we never have before. And so that has been my leadership vision. And man, it's been a grind, but I know it's a race. And although it's taken a lot out of me trying to kind of grab this land, like fighting for every inch, I think it's a once in a lifetime opportunity. And that's what we've tried to do.
When folks ask me, so you're going to do that also? You're going to also do that? My feeling in talking with colleagues like yourself who are also out there, I love the idea of grabbing as much land as possible to be able to make headway in this space. I mean, this is 400 years of inequality. We've got to make some headway. My feeling is, I don't want my grandkids to look back and say, Grandma, I thought you did some health equity stuff. What did you do in 2020? I have to have a reasonable response for them.
No, the urgency now is real. And I think for us, and you know, we've seen how long change takes. Mm-hmm. So then be presented with this opportunity and not go for it. That is the urgency now. So this is, in many ways, this was the chance we've been waiting for.
We prepared for.
Right. We built the credibility to be able to say, and now, here's what I got.
Yeah.
Let's go. And we didn't have to build credibility. We had the credibility, so we're ready to launch. And yeah. I think that's the exciting part about this. And it is about the rigor of execution, bringing the rigor of accountability to this work. Not hopes and dreams, not aspirations. Those haven't gotten us. They've gotten us progress, but not nearly anywhere close to where we want to be.
This work takes a lot out of us, particularly in this moment in time. We're all, as healthcare professionals, exhausted, emotionally, and some of us physically fatigued by the work, and adding onto it the other work that we have always done because it's so personal. So what do you do for self-care? What do you do to take care of you so that you are able to stay in this race?
Yeah, balance is really important. And a lot of things that I would have done in normal times, like going out and listening to music, going out and dancing, going out and dinner, going out and meeting friends, cocktail movies, all travel. I love travel. Mm-hmm. We just talked about travel before, like all those things were my balance, right? Exercise, those were all my balance. And so not only did this time take a lot out of us, but then the things that you counted on for balance were stripped from you, many of them, you know? Mm-hmm. Sports, like, you know, you couldn't watch any sports. I mean, so, but I'd say two things, Giselle. I think about my family in Puerto Rico who went 4 months after Hurricane Maria without water, power in 90 degrees, and they were resilient as heck. Like, if the worst I got to complain about is that I can't go to the movies or I can't, you know, like, you always got to think relative to others, like, how bad really is it? But the self-care is real. And I think exercise, like going out for a run, has always been something that clears my head, playing different sports. So I made sure that I never stopped any of that stuff, and that stuff that I could still do during these difficult times, because it was my time, burning a little energy is my time to kind of clear my head and also just take care of your body. I think trying to eat right, trying to be in touch with family and friends via Zoom. You know, it was a much more limited menu of the typical self-care and balance things. And I think I felt it, you know. I mean, I'd roll over, and still to this day, I'll roll over like 6 a.m. and I want to go back to sleep. Before, I used to sleep like a rock. Like, I mean, you and I know, like, after residency, you're like, I can sleep anyhow.
Right.
I used to pride myself on that.
Mm-hmm.
And man, if I don't roll over at 6 a.m. now, my mind just starts racing. And I can't shut it down. You know, that's been something that's been new. So being more diligent around sleep, I think, and rest is important. Those have been some of the things that I've tried to do that I think have been helpful. You know, and finding comfort in talking to people going through the same work. But it's hard because I think I still had a lot of clinical responsibilities, haven't had administrative and others. And so we all got full plates, but you got to try to have that balance. But it's hard. Giselle, because as you know, when you care deeply about your work, that balance, you know, the difference between kind of work and things that bring you gratification, that becomes a gray zone pretty quickly, right?
Yeah.
You could quickly like inch in and be like, damn, I haven't done anything fun for like a while because I'm getting gratification from all this because I've been wanting to do it and achieve these things for all this time and now I'm doing it, but then you're exhausted. So that self-care is really important. Those are, and reading wise, I end up doing a lot more kind of just being read my phone, not stories, but news and the like. So I think I've done an okay job. But everybody's got to find their right set of things.
Yeah. Do you have a leadership book or a book that you would recommend for folks?
You know, when I did the Commonwealth Fund Harvard University Fellowship in Minority Health Policy, I took a leadership class by this guy named Ron Heifetz, and he's written two books, Leadership
Adaptive.
Without Easy Answers and Leadership on the Line. Mm-hmm. And I think they're a fascinating and very completely non-traditional, as was his class, non-traditional approach or set of viewpoints about leadership and how do you bring people along. Really fascinating. So I think those have always remained. There's a lot of rah-rah leadership stuff out there, but those were, and he's a psychiatrist, interestingly, so, and a classically trained musician. He's a very interesting person. So that book is really, really interesting. I think those two books. And so those always have remained my kind of ones that I feel have been most influential on me.
What advice would you give your younger self?
Oh man, you know, I'm a person who doesn't live with a lot of regrets. And what advice would I give my younger self? That's interesting. I guess we always want to think that if we gave advice to our younger self, it would be to not do something. I mean, I think it's hard. I like many of us, walked a very, very narrow line going through high school and college and med school, meaning like the idea of kind of doing a semester abroad or doing anything that deviated from this very specific path seemed like, not seeing that probably from a risk standpoint, just couldn't take those risks, right? I can't go to Europe because if I run out of money, any money to...
Right.
No, but I guess my point is, if I were to give some advice to my younger self, it would be to maybe try, not be afraid to try one of those things. It's easier said now, right? But maybe try one or two of those things along the way that might have given me some other opportunities or things like that. I think professionally, though, I have to say, I mean, I think I was dealt a set of cards. I'm pretty happy with the way I played them. I just played them with the best information I had at the time. I don't think I've made any critical errors in my career that I regret. Could I've been done better in some places, you know, certainly could have done worse in others, but I'm all good. You know, I live life just being like proud of what I've done. I'm proud of what I've achieved. You know, it's just my philosophy.
It's a great response because it's an authentic response. Joe, thank you so much for this time together. This is one of the joys of this podcast, is getting to reconnect with people that I haven't seen in a little while. And so it's just so amazing to have this time with you, and I really appreciate it.
No, it's my pleasure. Thanks. It was great. This is like just you and I catching up. So
I know.
I guess you've learned a little bit more about me, but it's been a pleasure, and it's neat to get into that space of reflection. Sometimes we don't do it time, you know, we don't do it enough. And so hopefully I could turn the tables on you sometime.
Anytime. Anytime.
Thank you for having me. And I hope something I said here means something to someone out there. It's helpful. And I say it with all due humility, but with a lot of conviction and certainly with just being proud of where I am.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thanks to our listeners for joining us, and special thanks to Dr. Joe Betancourt. You can find Dr. Betancourt, follow him on Twitter at jbetancourtpr. This episode was edited by DeAndre Sawyer. Many thanks to the DKL production team with host Giselle Quilty-Smith, executive producer Sable Watson, producer and creative director Rachel Quinto, production assistants Jamie Eid and DeAndre Sawyer, and music by Mixout and Chill Out. If you liked what you heard, please rate us and leave a comment wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps others to find us. Like and comment on Facebook and Instagram at Different Kind of Leader, all one word, as well as on Twitter at DK Leadership. As always, we want to hear from you, our listeners, so please contact us at differentkindofleader@gmail.com. Let us know what leadership questions you have for guests and which inspiring leaders you would like for us to interview next. Join us next week for another episode of A Different Kind of Leader with Dr. Valerie Stone. As always, thanks for listening. This is A Different Kind of Leader.